Hello and welcome to an all-new episode of the 3-Bid League podcast. As always, I'm Tyler, joined by my co-host, Matt. And later in the episode, we're going to go back to our hot takes from the beginning of conference play. There are some bad ones in there, so stick around to hear those. But before that, we got a great returning guest for you, the voice of the UMass Minutemen men's basketball team, Jay Burnham. Thanks for joining us, Jay.
What's happening, guys? Hey, what is like a tease on one of those bad hot takes?
I know there's going to be some UMass ones in there. Oh. So we had a notable A10 Twitter and UMass friend Stu Ledecky come on. He had UMass pretty high up in the standings. So
we'll
see. Playing some better basketball.
We're only halfway there. They're 4-5 in conference play. They just came off a big win against Richmond. And then again, this past weekend over Duquesne, which is a very good team, by the way. That Duquesne team, I mean, you know, Keith Dambrot on the verge of 500 career wins has flipped that team in a heartbeat. And so UMass, as we record this on Monday, has a chance to go down to George Mason on Wednesday and make it 3 in a row. And then the schedule, if you're kind of a prognosticator, lightens up a little bit. So Stu and whoever's making those predictions, maybe not proved wrong yet.
Yeah, so you mentioned last week's wins, and the star of those wins, freshman RJ Luis, who had come back from an injury of his own, stepping up huge in the absence of Noah Fernandes, 23 points, 7 rebounds in the win over Richmond. And then, because he decided to one-up it against Duquesne, 31.6 rebounds in that. You had mentioned long before that game was over that he absolutely needed to be Rookie of the Week in the A-10. And he was indeed, and I will go far as to say that was the best week that any freshman has had in this conference all season.
Yeah, and it was the first 30-point game for a UMass player since Trey Mitchell did it in 2020 against LaSalle, if you remember how good he was, and now he's playing in the Big 12. A little background, I guess, for those that maybe haven't been following so closely. You know, UMass, their star player, Noah Fernandes, has been dealing with an ankle injury since in the non-conference slate against a win over Harvard. And so he's been in the lineup and then out of the lineup, and now he's missed 9 games. UMass, without him, has really had to lean on a couple of the younger guards who have really grown up quickly. And Keon Thompson, who's a true freshman, and then Rasul Diggins, who's a transfer sophomore from UConn. Those guys have started to play much better as of late, and that's opened up opportunities for RJ Luis. But also, the game that you're referencing where he scored 31 points, UMass was without Matt Cross, who's been one of the top scorers on the team and really one of the best rebounders in the league since he arrived from Louisville by way of Miami. So a lot to unpack there. You've got a true freshman, RJ Luis, who goes way back with his family with head coach Frank Martin. His father played for Coach Martin years ago. There's a bond and a trust there for those guys. And he's been really hard on the freshmen. That's just the way that Coach Martin operates. And I think the proof is in the pudding right now as to how those guys have matured, how they've developed in such a short amount of time, and really having to do so without a guy that UMass has leaned on for the past 2 years and Noah Fernandes. Now, the hope is that Fernandes, who I think is an all-league player, will come back in the very near future, maybe on Wednesday against George Mason, who knows, this upcoming Saturday against Davidson. But if he does and he starts to play the way that we know he's capable of, this team could be that team that started out 6-1, 7-2 to begin the year and won the Myrtle Beach Invitational.
And look, until these two games happened, I still considered UMass to be a poor offensive team without Noah Fernandes in the lineup. You throw in losing Matt Cross for one of those games too. If you told me that was what the week was going to look like, I would have said that they should have been pretty happy just to go 1-1. Instead, they get 2 wins out of it. They could have been sitting at 2-7 with those injuries. Now, like you mentioned, they're at 4-5, right in the middle of the pack.
And you can kind of flip it the other way too, right? We were saying, well, if they had played better against LaSalle, if they were healthy against St. Joe's, you know, maybe they've got 2 more wins and they're 6-3. And that's the world that we live in with the Atlantic 10, right? Where you have one. I think every team has one that they would certainly love to get back, right? I mean, ask St. Louis. They came to UMass and lost. I'd love to see the road winning percentage of teams in the Atlantic 10. Has been very difficult for all these clubs to win on the road. But I think one of the great things for UMass is that they're just so tough. They're physical. They embody the identity of their head coach and Frank Martin. And now you add a guy that can score at all three levels like RJ Lewis, really makes your offense flow a lot better. They're getting fast break buckets. They've got a guy that comes off the bench and provides an extensive amount of energy. And DeAndre Dominguez, he's coming off his first career double-double. And this is an offense that, you know, for the past, I joke around, you know, for the last 4 years since I've been here, my brother would come to games and he would say, man, he's like, you guys don't dunk the basketball at all. And well, this year it's totally different. There's alley-oops, there's high-flying plays. There's a guy that's also a true freshman, Tafara Gapare, that can really light up the scoreboard and the highlight reel. So they're emerging as a team that can get you a couple different ways. And they can shoot three pretty well, and they're very selective in doing so.
How important do you think the depth is for this UMass team? Because where I look at it, one of the most up-tempo teams in the conference. We just saw it this week with two games above 80 points. And on the defensive end, you know Frank Morton's going to have his guys playing as intense as anybody. So right now, the Minutemen leading the nation in bench minutes. Do you think that's an important component of this team where they play so hard that they need 9, 10, 11 guys each night?
I think you saw it in the Richmond game where UMass was able. I mean, there's a key stretch in the game in the second half where Richmond started to pull away. And UMass is sticking with their true freshman Keon Thompson for a 4-minute play, not only to develop him as a player, but also to give other guys a rest. And then when you flip it to the end of the game, last 5 minutes, UMass is attack, attack, attack. You know, heading into the season, I thought it would be more of a like a grinded out type defense, like you see again, like a team like North Texas who really chokes you out. UMass faced them earlier this season, but it's been more up tempo and it's been a lot of fun to watch, to be honest with you. It's an amazing product on the court, and I think the fans are starting to really key in on that as well. But I do think it's frustrating for other teams. It's definitely frustrating for other broadcasters when they look at the sheet and they're saying, well, who do I put on my damn depth chart? I got 12 guys that all play 15 minutes or more. And, you know, that's something that Coach Martin has done throughout his career. And at least for the moment, it's working out.
Yeah. And before we keep this rolling, I will mention, you said it's been tough to win on the road in the A-10 this year. Well, road teams are 23-42 to start out conference play. So,
and that's after George Mason gave one away at home Sunday night or afternoon.
So you mentioned the excitement of this team. And when you were talking about the dunking, I think we were probably both thinking of the same play in our head. Tafara Gapare against Duquesne going with like a triple Euro step through the lane, throwing down a one-hander. And you know what? You do a great job on these ESPN Plus broadcasts of keeping it pretty even keeled. You got a lot of away fans listening, and so that's very important. But I'll be honest, I think I needed to hear you lose your mind on that Gapare dunk.
Thanks, man. I appreciate that. And you know, there's probably a larger conversation we could have about the emerging and evolving media that we live in, right? Like our broadcast is on NESN and it's on ESPN Plus. And it could very well be a homered UMass broadcast. But yeah, we do try to make it kind of a 60-40 split to where you know that there's the league watching, you know there's the visiting teams watching, and you want to be a professional about it. And I think there's probably going to be at some point standards that get thrown down from either the league or the NCAA as more of these schools have to produce the games themselves. And therefore you're in charge of the announcers, in charge of the content. We really try to develop our storylines there too. So I'll pick a bunch of different players that the opposing team has and try to tell their story as well. So thank you for picking up on that, Tyler. I really appreciate it. I do keep that in mind. Like, you know, I do try to dial up the energy. I think we bring a lot of energy to the broadcast. But I also am wary of being memeified or social media fight where you're just screaming and losing your head. And so you see those great plays in college basketball. Maybe this is what makes college basketball great. And I'm missing out where a play happens, a half court shot happens, and the dude loses his voice completely. And you don't even know what's going on if you weren't, you know, watching intently. So I'll keep that in mind next time. I'll come up with some slam-a-lama ding dong or something for you for the broadcast.
Yeah, and while we're on a little timeout from the UMass basketball talking about the broadcast, There was a moment, first half of that Duquesne game, in which the scoreboard graphic went completely berserk.
Oof.
And eventually you guys had to, it seemed to me like there was a camera actually just aimed at the scoreboard on the side of the court showing us.
Yeah, they
us.
Superimposed it. Yeah. Yeah.
Like when you're broadcasting, do you have a guy in your ear telling you, hey, scoreboard's out, or are you seeing that on your monitor and
have
to kind of pick it up on your own?
Yeah, that's a great point. We have one monitor, and I think a lot of these schools, this is another thing too, where everything is permanent on today's internet, right? So if something goes down, people are there, they'll make fun of it. I know there's teams in our league that certainly get hit because of their broadcast production, or maybe someone misses a play with a camera. The truth is, if you really want to go into the nuts and bolts of it behind the curtain, a lot of these schools, ourselves included, are using students, and they're at the mercy of technology working and not having an A1 or an engineer or backup engineer to make sure you fix things on the fly. We are fortunate that we have a phenomenal guy in our production truck or room by the name of Taylor Wink and Drew Holcreve too, I should say. But UMass also, for some reason, has the longest winter break known to man. We haven't had students on campus since before Christmas, and that won't return till January 6th. So it's really two guys doing most of the heavy lifting. And when something goes down like that, it's very difficult to engineer it and to fix it on the fly. So I can see it on the monitor, and you know, just being a radio guy, you just say the score until people are sick of you, and then you say the time. But yeah, it happens. It doesn't only happen at this level. It happens if you watch national broadcasts, stuff goes wrong, and that's just the nature of live sports.
And it sounds simple, but so many announcers just don't do it. My dad was incredibly happy that you kept giving us the score.
Okay.
Because so often, like, a situation like that happens and you'll go a good 10, 15 minutes and only hear the score going into the commercial break. So
yeah,
he
and
was
especially
really appreciative of that.
It's a close game too. And, you know, that's another thing about guys that are my age. You know, you get into this business as a radio guy, and then all of a sudden you're just asked to do TV because that's a medium that's taken over. When I first started doing broadcasting, being on TV was a huge get. It was hard to get opportunities in 2001 in college and to get a TV game. And now it's a norm. And so I do think there's a younger group, especially when it comes to the baseball broadcasting, which you'll see a lot of guys call a radio game as if the audience can see it on TV. And that's just obviously not the case. And it's a dying art, I think.
Yeah. And one more broadcast specific question I got for you before we get back to the Minutemen.
Is anybody still listening to us, or hopefully?
Of course. We got okay. A great guest today. It's the later half of the episode where we wonder if people stick around. But if there was an instance where, let's say, a student decides to pull a prank and pretends to be a delivery guy walking onto the court, how would you have handled that in the moment? Because I thought the Duquesne guys did a pretty good job of it.
Okay, so first of all, I have watched the Duquesne broadcasts, and those guys, you talk about over the top, they can really lay the hammer on some crazy calls. So credit to them. But when I watched that clip, I was so impressed that they knew what the hell was happening. He was on, and I don't order food delivery, so I probably would have gone way over my head. I forget the gentleman's name now, but he was on Uber Eats within like 30 seconds. I thought it was very impressive. They handled it great. They played it off, you know, a joke or two, and then they kind of moved on with the game. I also think, if I'm looking at the court orientation correctly, where the guy came in, that's usually the blind spot of where the broadcasters are, because there's VIP seats along the court and you can't see in that corner. So hopefully, I think they probably had some people kind of telling them, hey, this is what happened. Someone stepped on the court. But yeah, he picked that up quickly. I would have been lost. Absolutely lost.
Has anything like that ever happened to you calling a basketball or another sport where maybe not a delivery person, finds their way on?
16 years full-time, 18 years overall in minor league baseball. Like in Greensboro, North Carolina, there's a dog the dog's name was Babe Ruff. And, you know, middle of the game, dog runs on the field. It's the bat dog. So it goes out and gets the bats and entertains the fans in between innings. And it goes out and just does a number two right in center field during the game. And you're just, everyone's just sitting around looking at each other, trying to figure out how to move on. So a million different types. We had a game when I was in Richmond where the outfield wall blew down. But those are things you can see, right? So you kind of like, you're up in your perch, you can see it. When some dude walks onto the court and interferes with the game live, that's tough to kind of get out of your mode of broadcasting and focusing on what's going on and then see, trying to figure out, like, why are we stopped here?
Yeah, and like we said, props to those guys for handling it so well. But we'll take it back to UMass. And
okay.
Before we got off on this little tangent, we had mentioned Keon Thompson and all of the options that UMass has. Well, without Fernandes, they've had to rely on Thompson and Rashul Diggins to handle the point guard spot. And I'm on record in print from a few weeks ago saying that I thought UMass should try a little experiment, play Matt Cross at the point, because those guys have been struggling so much. Well, ever since I wrote that, Rashul Diggins has played the best basketball of his season. So what's been going on with him? Because he's gone from a guy who was shooting the ball terribly percentage-wise to now a huge asset to this team in their win streak.
Yeah, and in your defense, there was a game, a couple games where UMass got in foul trouble and they used Cross or TJ Weeks to try and run the point because they only had those two guys. I talked to Coach Martin about this quite a bit over the last couple weeks, and he's like, look, this is a guy that didn't play. You got the COVID situation for a lot of these kids coming out of high school, didn't play at UConn, transfers to UMass, not playing a lot, has the birth of his first child, which occurred last month. And there's just a million things going on in a young player's head. And I think when you start off cold, maybe you second guess yourself. You're trying to, you know, establish yourself in a program. And as a guy that was a prolific scorer in the Philly Catholic League, which is no joke. And then he gets off the schneid against Richmond, shoots 4 or 5 from 3-point range. But I think the more impressive thing was the assist, the turnover number in that contest. I think it was 6-0 in terms of assists to turnovers, and really starting to figure out how to run the offense. He's sneaky. He's got speed. He can create steals. And I think he's starting to learn like where he can pick his spots in terms of penetrating the basketball and then dishing to a shooter or trying to create a shot of his own. So I've been thoroughly impressed with the way that Rasul has been able to carry the load for UMass. And I think the sky's the limit for both those young players.
Another guy I wanted to hit on and get your take with this year, new coach, a lot of guys leaving the program last year. So there were a whole bunch of freshmen and transfers coming in. And I think with that, one of the returning players, DeAndre Dominguez, kind of didn't get as much attention from fans as he should have, but he started to become one of the most efficient players in the A-10, over 40% from three, over 60% from two. How important has he been for the Minutemen? Because I feel like you mentioned picking your spots. I think he does that as well as anyone in the conference right now.
He does, and he's just so much fun to watch, and he's got a lot of attitude and energy. You know, we asked Coach Martin about him. He had that first double-double of his career on Saturday, and he said, Coach Martin essentially said, look, when I took over and you go to the roster that he inherited, there wasn't a lot of recruiting done the last season of Coach McCall. I think that was by design to say, look, like this is a all or nothing situation. So most of the guys maxed out their eligibility. The other ones left and you're sitting there, you got TJ Weeks, Noah Fernandes and DeAndre Dominguez. And Coach Martin said that he asked DeAndre what he wanted to be, not what Coach Martin wanted him to be. He said, what do you want to be? And then I will help you achieve what you want to be. And they've been able to execute that. The efficiency's been off the charts. He can score inside. He can score outside. He can lob the ball. He can slam the ball. Like there's a lot that he provides for this team. And I don't know how much more they can get out of him because he's just been so incredibly efficient. But there might be a whole nother level there that we're not even seeing in terms of a second league or all league player. So it's a guy that that's in his third year here at UMass, and he's really blossoming into one of the more important players in the A-10.
So by my count, we've now mentioned 9 of the 12 scholarship players for this team. And it kind of helps to prove the point I'm about to make here. We have not said a word about Wildens Levesque, who is a guy that really is not a part of the conversation, certainly not on the whole A-10 level, and really not amongst the UMass fans that I'm exposed to. But yet, they lost both of the games that he missed in conference play. And I thought that he was the second most important player in the win against Duquesne because of the physicality he had, shutting down one of the best offensive rebounding teams in the league. And when he went into foul trouble and had to come out of the game in the second half, I truly thought for a moment that that was going to be what would lose the game for UMass.
You guys are pretty good in your observations. I don't know how long you prepare for these conversations, but that was a pretty astute point. So credit to you, Tyler. That is absolutely true. And I think what you maybe don't see in the numbers for Wildons Levesque, for those that don't know, he was the transfer that came over with Coach Martin and his staff from South Carolina. Brockton, Mass native. He was a top five recruit in the state of Massachusetts when he was coming out of high school. And his defense and toughness are second to none for what this team needs. The one thing that has been an issue for him, and I think it just might be a little bit of bad luck in there, is that he's missed quite a few putbacks, bunnies, shots at point blank range. If you look at the UMass stats, this would be a perplexing number. When you take their 2-point field goal percentage and compare it to the 3-point field goal percentage or overall field goal percentage, field goal efficiency per KenPom has actually been one of the worst in the country. So they've missed some close shots. That's starting to even out now. When they went through that stretch early on in the non-conference slate, they just couldn't seem to get any luck. And I think Wildons was at the forefront of that. So yeah, with him back there after missing those two games with injury, you've got him and then another guy that's been around, sixth year guy in Isaac Conte, who came in from LAU Brooklyn by way of Hofstra, by way of Georgia. He's been a huge asset for UMass as well. So those two big guys, I think they can bang down low with any other team in the Atlantic 10. And if they're on, UMass can get the paint touches they need and the points in the paint to then open up some of the spaces on the perimeter.
Yeah, and to really drive home your point, 2-point field goal percentage for the Minutemen, 340th out of 363 great. Teams in the nation.
But then their 3-point percentage is like they're like 50% the last four games. It's been amazing.
Yeah, and for comparison on that 2-point number, it's ever so slightly below LaSalle, which I think anyone who's watched the Explorers this year knows they are an awful 2-point shooting team. So
yeah. And look, I'll make this point for you guys too. When you talk about where this program is, year one of Coach Frank Martin, now 300 career wins for him, you know, going back year by year, it's been, I think, 9 years since the A-10 went to an 18 league schedule. That sounds right. Derek Kellogg, who was the head coach, who's now on staff as an assistant coach. And they also have Coach Edwards, who is also a head coach. So you got three head coaches on the staff, which provides incredible depth. But UMass won 10 games in league in 2014-15. Since then, they've won 8 just once. They're 4-5 now. They're playing well. They have a chance to eclipse their best league season in 7 years. They've got 13 overall wins, and they haven't had more than 15 wins in a season total since, you got to go back to their 14-15 year as well. So they're tracking to have one of the best years, even if it's not by VCU standards. Great. They're tracking to have one of the best years that this school's seen in the last decade. And I think that's nothing but a positive momentum for the program. And you've got a very aggressive collective that is formed, dedicated solely to Massachusetts basketball, providing NIL opportunities. It's the Mass Collective. They've already signed multiple players on UMass. The goal is to retain and, of course, entice players to come to the University of Massachusetts. And my lights just went out here. And I think they're doing a good job of kind of in tandem as this thing grows with Coach Martin, you know, at the helm, helping us get to where we need to go.
Yeah, since this is an audio pod, Jay is
okay.
Not
the video
kidding.
Doesn't matter. All right,
we could just see the glow of his microphone for about the last minute of that right there, to give everyone a little context. But
great.
Yeah, I mean, things are going well, and there's even a celebrity row at the game now. The camera kept flashing over to the Reindeer Kid sitting with Tafara Gapare's dad, Nelson, who commutes in from Spain for these games. And I don't know why. I just kept laughing as they kept showing those two. It seemed like such an unlikely duo to be sitting courtside.
We had Ray Allen here last month. Hanging out.
Was that the Rhode Island game? Stands.
I think it was, yeah, the roadie game. I got the guys in my head that are producers like, hey, we're going to show Ray Allen. He's sitting over there somewhere. I was like, wait, what? Like the Ray Allen? Yeah. So, you know, and I do think, yeah, first of all, Nelson Gapare, who's the father of Tafara Gapare, just provides so much energy, flew in for a couple of the games. He's getting the whole crowd riled up in the sidelines. And of course, the famous UMass Reindeer kid who had been AWOL for a while because of the winter break back. So that certainly provides a boost. And look, the goal for UMass is to get the Mullen Center back to what it used to be, which was an intense and terrifying place for opponents to play. I grew up in the Refuse to Lose, John Calipari era, living here in Western Massachusetts. And I think a lot of people know what it can be. It hasn't been that in quite some time. And I think we're tracking in the right direction. But it's also cool to see, yeah, those celebrities start to kind of make their way in. You know, we're only 90 minutes from Boston. We're 2.5 hours from New York City. It's a great place to spend a night. And I think plus you're obviously in the backyard of the Basketball Hall of Fame, which had a huge tournament last weekend with Bronny James and Carlos Boozer's kids and all that stuff, the Hoop Hall Classic. So it's a great place for basketball for sure.
So how's the energy been in the Mullen Center this year? Because when the camera pans out, there's still a lot of empty seats, but just watching from at home, it seems to be a little louder and a little bit more full than at least it was last season.
Yeah, and it's tough. Again, you've been without students for a month, so you take out that component. It's a huge facility. It's 9,000 plus seats. It's also got the hockey component, so you're a little bit further set off the court. But it's the best it's been since I've been here as a full-time employee going back to 2018-19. And I think, you know, look, they're 4-5 in A-10 play. Couple of wins, you string it together, all of a sudden you're at the top of the league and more people start paying attention to what you're doing.
Yeah, and so I guess we'll dive into the biggest story of the week. Before the wins, Frank Martin had comments about some of the things that fans were saying online about his players, and most of the commentary focus after that has been on the relationship between him and some of those fans. But there's a whole nother component to this, and that's his guys in the locker room. And if you're a UMass player, you saw your coach go out there and give a really impassioned speech on your behalf. Now, maybe it's coincidence that they came out and played two great games after that, but did you see any kind of energy change from the players? Like, did this have any kind of galvanizing impact?
No, I think they're pretty even keel. You know, they're dialed in and focused and listening to the message that the coaching staff has built. But, you know, we even saw, what was it, the Dayton game where they lost to VCU, where was it Anthony Grant came out and was talking about the backlash that his players were getting from bettors. That happens on a daily basis for not only A-10 basketball players, but college athletes in general. I don't pay attention that much on social media. So if I was a student athlete, I probably would act that way as well. But it's hard because that's where all your friends are. That's where your society is where your teammates are. I think it's a tough world for a student athlete at this juncture. And I've seen people comment to say, well, you're supposed to get the criticism because you can get paid now, which is a huge misnomer because most of these guys, college athletes, I should say, aren't getting paid, or they're getting some small stipend or some NIL money that hasn't fully breached the gap yet, even though at UMass I think they're ahead of the curve in terms of the collective stuff. But yeah, I think Frank is he's defensive of his players, and I think the guys appreciate that. And I think there's also a scenario where, you know, we're dealing, we talk as a society about mental health, right, and how important it is. And then at the same time, we tell everyone that they suck the moment something goes the way they don't like it to. The UMass fans are great. I think this is probably more of a larger conversation than just one school. But I will say this, if you don't have people talking or upset that you don't do things well, then you're in an indifferent fan base. And that's even worse. I think that's harder to come back from. UMass fans are passionate. They're ready for a winner. I think they're on the right track.
Yeah. And that's one of the toughest
question or not, but well, it's tough. Yeah.
It did. And that's one of the toughest lines to toe. And I know Curry Hicks Sage said this on the night after Martin made his comments, that it is tough because the people who are making these comments are typically the most impassioned fans. And Matt and I talked about it afterwards too, where there's a line. It's okay for someone to go online and say, oh, well, we think player A should play instead of player B. But when you're going after player B over and over and over again, then it starts to become a different conversation.
We have to adjust to a world. And look, like, I've been through it all. Like 1999, I'm using dial-up internet to listen to Red Sox games when I'm going to school in Hawaii. And from there, we live in a world now where everyone can give you their opinion all the time. And I don't know if we as a society are trained appropriately to learn how to deal with that. And it's easy to just say ignore it. But I mean, we know that the negative always rises to the top. And, you know, I'm just going to say this is a larger conversation. But I think I really enjoy the fact that the UMass basketball coach has his players back no matter what, and however context he decides to display that.
Yeah. And Frank Martin over the years has proven that if nothing else, he will be impassioned and he will be loyal. So that's something that he's definitely bringing to the UMass fans.
Yeah. I mean,
to this school,
if someone who had never brought, like, if this happens all the time in broadcasting, right? Someone tweets at you and tells you you're no good and they have zero experience in broadcasting a game or know nothing about the behind the scenes, which is always, you know, what you see is the iceberg, right? The top of the iceberg, but everything else below it is what's making things go and what happens behind the scenes. So you get upset when people that aren't in your profession tell you how to, especially if you're successful in your profession, tell you how to operate your profession. And I think sports is the only place that really happens, sports and broadcasting. No one goes to a doctor's office. Actually, no, I take that back, because now this past year we told all the doctors what, you know, how to doctor and, you know, how to vaccine, which is a whole nother conversation.
Teachers too. So, everybody's taking criticism now.
Yeah, everyone's an expert, right? Yeah. Everyone's an expert something happens in politics and all of a sudden everyone's a international relations expert or a constitutional lawyer expert. It's just, and I do think there's a large minority, a small minority of people in general that are the ones that are going after coaches for the betting stuff or blowing a gambling thing, but it's visible and that sucks.
And I think it's a lot easier for people to come out and act like an expert when things aren't going well. Like, they weren't for UMass the past month, but this last week, these two games have reminded us that this was one of the most exciting and most successful teams of the non-conference.
Go to Tuscaloosa, Alabama after a loss against Troy and see what the vibe is at those schools. I mean, you know, we all love A-10 basketball, and I think it's great. And there's dedicated fan bases, but it can be dangerous when you're in a spot and it's just, you know, especially those Power Five schools where like the whole town of Blacksburg is a dark mess after a home loss against Virginia. And I don't know if that's good for the collective consciousness of our well-being.
So we'll pan back out here to the larger picture of the conference, and we're now at a point in the season where you've gotten to see about half the league up close and personal now. Where do you think UMass fits into this conference when things are all said and done in March?
Man, you're gonna call me. So this is where you're gonna call me a homer. I look at this as, you know, maybe UMass should have beat LaSalle. That was a home game that admittingly they say got away from them. It was a midweek Tuesday game. There wasn't a lot of juice there. And then a game on the road at St. Joe's, where I think they certainly had a great opportunity to come away with a win and didn't. I think they're a top of the league team still. I thought that when they won the Myrtle Beach Invitational. I actually think that more now after what we've seen from RJ Lewis and Rasul Diggins, with guy the two top scorers being out and those guys stepping up. That Duquesne team, first of all, they don't give up. They're scrappy as all can be. They're dangerous. They got hit with some foul trouble that certainly benefited UMass, and I think they're pretty tricky. The one that really surprises me right now is the way that St. Louis has played without Fred Thatch Jr. I thought that dude was a glue guy. He's a guy that you need. Every coach will tell you they want a Fred Thatch on their team, and he went down towards the end or towards the middle of the game against UMass, and that's the only loss they've had on their schedule. I thought that would spiral them out of control. It didn't. They've actually played better since then. So kudos to Coach Ford and what he's got going on there. And then VCU, actually a little disappointing for that loss against St. Bonaventure, because it felt like UMass went down to VCU. VCU was, I think, they're in the midst of a 2 or 3 game winning streak. They blew the doors off of the Minutemen. You know, that place is rocking. So for St. Bonaventure to get that win at the Siegel Center gives you the idea that no one freaking knows what's going to happen when we get to Brooklyn. And I think that's going to be exciting. I think that's great. I mean, for UMass, they beat the best team in the league. VCU lost to St. Bonaventure. I mean, you can go down the list, right? George Mason just had it moving in the right direction, and then they fall fat. Now St. Joseph's has run 1-4 in a row with guys that can really shoot the heck out of the basketball. But to answer your question point blank, I think UMass is a top 5 team in the league. If they can change around the last, if they can build on this momentum, I think that'll bear out.
Yeah, it's a mess in the middle of the standings at this point. And Matt and I will talk about it later, how we've just reached a point that nothing is predictable anymore. And you look at a week like UMass just had, beating Richmond and Duquesne. Those are two really important tiebreakers to have. Like, that's a week that could be the difference for the Minutemen for being a 4 or 5 seed versus a 10 or 11 seed, and making you have to head out to New York for a Tuesday afternoon game.
Yeah, no doubt. Let's avoid that by all means. And, you know, you look at the schedule that the Minutemen have coming up. They've got Mason, then Davidson, which hasn't been the Davidson that we've been accustomed to. Davidson at home. And then there's a contest in there. It's at Fordham, which has played very well this year. They've got another shot at LaSalle, then Chicago, Loyola, and Rhode Island. So you've got those teams that are kind of in the middle of the pack that you get a chance to go after. And again, like, it's, if you're playing well, just the way they are, they're playing with confidence. Any given night in the Atlantic 10, I think I was looking at the line the other day before we went on air. Fordham was a favorite at home against George Washington, and GW had the momentum. I thought for sure that they were going to win that game, and they end up losing by double figures. It's crazy.
Yeah, so. And that was a game George Washington dominated the first half too. Yeah, and then Fordham came back.
Yeah.
So from your perspective in UMass, what's the most interesting thing you've seen in the A-10 this year, whether it's either a team or just a player that blew you away?
Let me go back. Okay, I love Dumpf. Everyone loves Coach Dumphy. And look at what he's done. I know the numbers aren't fully there for his team, but they're competitive in every single game. And I think they had the lead last against Rhode Island on Saturday. They couldn't pull it out. The storyline for me is when you take guys like that. Like, we had that game on Saturday. It was Coach Frank Martin against Keith Dambrot. That's almost 799 combined career wins between those two guys. Coach Dumphy comes back into the fold. Rhode Island gets their man. Look at what George Washington is doing. I think the pedigree of coaches, both young and new, is higher than it's been in quite some time. And I don't know if there's any way we could statistically bear this out, but that might be one of the reasons why the parity is what it is, because of the level of coaching that has been raised by the A-10. And I give the league a lot of credit for, you know, leaning on these teams and these programs to say, hey, let's get big, let's get better, let's be national. And having a guy like UMass with Frank Martin and Coach Dunphy, certainly relevant in the Big Five world for sure. Coach Martin relevant nationally. There's national stories that he has written about him and his family throughout the course of the season. That to me is the biggest storyline from what we've seen. And then two, we saw George Washington. I'm going to forget who it was. Dean, was it the guy, he played the best game of his career against UMass down at GW. And I think there's like those moments that you catch a guy that has his career day and you say, oh man, like I never really thought much about him, but now he's implanted in my brain, and now he's there amongst A-10 lore for me.
I think that's how Duquesne fans are going to feel about RJ Louise until he comes back probably next year and then puts up 25 on them again.
Probably, you know, we had a game against George Mason a couple years ago, and UMass had a lead. It was up by 10, and this guy Jamal Hartwell comes off the bench and just starts firing threes, and he got like 4 out of 5. Duquesne had a guy who was the little guy
last year.
No, it was 3 years ago. He transferred out.
Oh, Tavian Dunmartin.
Tavian Dunmartin. He looked like Steph Curry. He dropped 28 against UMass. And just like, that's the beauty of this game, is that you have those moments. You say, wow, like you catch a guy on any given night and he gets his name in the record books.
I mean, I personally thought Tavian Dunmartin was one of the best players in this league for years on end. So I can't give a fair opinion on that.
I legit thought he was Steph Curry the day he played UMass.
I mean, he certainly had some big moments, but we'll get you towards
the close. My wife says it's dinner time. So.
Oh, well, we were about to get you towards the close here anyway, but you mentioned that you went to school in Hawaii, which I did not know about you. And I got to ask this for sake of the guys at the West Pine Bills, who I know are definitely still listening at this point. Favorite Hawaiian island?
So I was a broke college kid when I went to Hawaii. I was 17 years old. I got on a plane from Western Mass and I said, I'm going to college at Hawaii Pacific University. So I only really was on one island, and that was Oahu. So I can't fully answer that question. But if I could do it all over again, I certainly would go back with more money and more free time.
Well, Oahu's still a wonderful place.
Not bad.
So yes, not a bad answer to be the only answer, but we'll close it out here. You've spent a lot of time broadcasting minor league baseball games. You're currently the play-by-play man for the Worcester WooSox.
Worcester.
I'm trying to say that as is that actually
not a New England
Worcester
guy?
Is? I thought Worcester. This whole time I thought Worcester and Worcester were different places. So apparently my parents still claim that I had a good Boston accent back in the day, just with the word sass, but that's about it. So we'll end it here. Favorite minor league baseball story that you can tell us on the air?
I tell people this. This is, people always ask you what your home run call is when you started getting into this business. And you're at a party and you're 25 years old, or your mom's birthday party, and people come up to you and they're like, what's your home run call? And it just feels so contrite and forced. And you're like, oh, I got to have a home run call. Well, here's the, no, you don't, first of all. And you don't have to say the same thing every time someone hits a home run. But I actually do have a home run call I use sometimes because of what happened when I was in independent baseball. I was the voice of the Pensacola Pelicans, which was an independent Central Baseball League and American Association. And we played from Pensacola to El Paso, which is a 26-hour bus ride. And then Pensacola all the way up to St. Paul, Minnesota, which was also 26 hours on a bus. Now, one year we decided to fly, and this was just post 9/11. And our general manager had bought tickets for the entire team to fly from Pensacola to El Paso, and then we were going to bus back and stop in multiple towns and play games and come back to Pensacola. So he bought the team flights in April. Well, by the time the flights took place in June, half our team was released, gone, hurt, or whatever. So we had only like 12 or 13 guys that actually had tickets that corresponded with their name. And the post 9/11 world, like, you can't just walk in with someone else's ticket and be like, hey, this is me. And we were at the airport at 6 a.m. that morning, and all of our guys were like, hey, like, I don't have a ticket. And so our manager was handing out tickets to the players who weren't there at the beginning of the season with the guys who are gone. So he's like, okay, Tyler Cronin, you're now Carlos Mendoza here. And they wouldn't let him in. And so I called our general manager and I was like, hey, I was like, this is what's happening. And he's like, no, you just lie and say it's like, you know, you're Tyler Cronin and not the other guy. And so we left half our team at the airport. And as we're taking off, I came up with like my line. I was like, all right, well, we're soaring so long. And I said goodbye to the team. And that ended up being my, like, one of the things I used throughout baseball is the home run is soaring so long, as we left half our team at the airport and then landed in El Paso and played with like 12 guys the next day and lost like 18-2. So that's a glimpse into the world of early 2000s independent baseball.
Were there at least enough pitchers to get through that game?
No, we used our first baseman, Larry Bethea. You can look at the box score against the El Paso Diablos. And Larry came in the eighth inning, and he was like a big poppy type. He was big dude, started pitching. And then the league commissioner like sent our manager a message the next day and was like, you're making a mockery of the game. Please don't do that again. And he's like, well, we left half our damn team at the airport because we didn't have the right tickets to get them on the airplane.
All right, I just had to look this up. Baseball Reference. Yeah, he did get an inning. He's in there. 2005.
2005?
It's impressive stuff.
All right, well, there is nothing that matter I can say right now to top that story. So I think we've got to close it there.
Jay Thanks, Burnham, guys.
Thank you for joining us.
I'll see you in Brooklyn. All right, we'll do it
again. Absolutely.
Okay. Keep up the good work.
Yeah, everyone be sure to tune in to UMass's games on NESN and ESPN Plus to catch Jay. It is a great broadcast.
All right. Thanks, guys.
All right. So the biggest game of the weekend, VCU falling at home to St. Bonaventure, 61-58, knocks the Rams out of first place. They would have had a half game lead once again had they won. They now slide all the way to a half game back, but this is a game with much bigger implications than just the top of the standings. It comes pretty close to killing just about any slight hope that the VCU fans had of sneaking in on the bubble when you combine this with the home loss to Jacksonville. And maybe more important than all of this, it sadly destroys my hope that St. Bonaventure would go 9-9 with all of their wins at home, all their losses on the road. Although I guess they lost to Fordham at the Riley Center anyway, but I still wanted to see them go 0-9 on the road in conference play just for the fun of it.
That would have been fun. And you would think for a team that struggled on the road so much, you wouldn't have thought that first win would come at the Siegel Center, one of the toughest home court environments in the A-10. But yeah, shocking result. I think this had to be the biggest money line upset of the year. VCU was like an 11 or 12 point favorite.
11.5 it closed.
And they led by 11 too pretty early on in the game. Looked like they were going to cruise to their fourth straight double digit victory for a while. But I think the story here, we've talked about how Daryl Banks has had to carry the Bonnies so much this year, for better or worse. Like, some of these games he's going off, but it just doesn't work out. Well, against VCU, he only had 6 points, and it was the other guys. How about Jan Farrell making 5 3-pointers, leading the way with 15 points? And then Moses Flowers also chipping in with 15. So some of the role players stepping up in a big way.
Look, if you hold Kyra Luke and Daryl Banks to a combined 10 points, I would expect you to beat St. Bonaventure 100 times out of 100. And the defense was pretty good all game, except for the fact that Jan Farrell kept getting loose in the second half. He went 5 of 7 from three. Moses Flowers went 3 of 6. The entire rest of the team did not make a shot outside the arc. And it was those two starting forwards. By the way, we saw a lineup change from St. Bonaventure, starting Flowers over Barry Evans. I believe it is the first starting lineup change that the Bonnies have made since they put Jalen Attaway in for Justin Winston 3 years ago. Although I may be wrong, I'm not sure Chad Venning started to start the year, but it was a rarity for the Bonnies, and it definitely worked.
Well, and despite some of the offensive struggles from the Stars, they played to one of their greatest strengths, which is limiting opponents from the three-point line. And VCU, after being on fire for most of conference play, they're over 40% right now from three in the league. Well, they went 2 for 16, and that was the difference maker, just not getting that type of outside production. They still didn't have a terrible offensive game, especially when you compare it to some of their early games in the season. But overall, just a great defensive game for the Bonnies, too.
Yeah, and it was troubled from beyond the arc for VCU in this game. The bugaboo that killed them against Duquesne killed them in some of those non-conference losses. 2 of 16 from deep. Shriver only hit one. Nunn only hit one. It's all the things that we've talked about with the Rams offense that they had gotten over on their win streak all came back to hurt them again. Jameer Watkins had 2 points. Nunn had six. Johns had seven. And because this team does not have 20-point scorers, they have to have three, four guys pitching in double digits to win these games.
And so now the big consequence of this, St. Louis just took the lead in the A-10, getting rid of the Belk curse in another great Friday night matchup. And A-10 has just been killing it with these ESPN2 games so far this year. It delivered once again, where the Billikens held on for a narrow 4-point win, trailing for a lot of the game against Davidson. It looked like the Wildcats' home court advantage would pull through, and they were just getting timely shots, but St. Louis just didn't go away. And all of a sudden, after some disappointment early in the year, they've rattled off a nice little winning streak, and they lead the way at 7-1, still extending the best start of the Travis Ford era.
Everyone started calling it the Belk curse, that they had never won in that arena. And with how hot the Billikens started and the fact that they didn't blow this game, makes me wonder, was it a Belk curse or was it just a Bob McKillop is awesome curse?
And that's got to be part of it. He had good records against a lot of A-10 teams. But for me, one of the most important things here, like when St. Louis was trailing, they went on a cold streak at the end of the first half. They were just making so many dumb mistakes. I think they fouled the three-point shooter three or four times. One of them was an and one by Cochera. They had some silly turnovers, just giving up easy baskets. But they just never went away. And eventually Davidson, like that. One of the funniest things too, I think the Wildcats made their first two or three shots of the game from deep. And it's like, all right, the worst Davidson shooting team ever is still going to light up St. Louis. But then it didn't happen. They started locking down on defense more, and eventually you knew Davidson would go cold. They only went 8 for 27 on threes. But, yeah, I mean, this is just a tough matchup playing against not a great team, but someone that's going to have a nice home crowd supporting them. And that's the type of game you need to win a regular season title.
Yeah, and they got it, and they got it with contributions all around the team in the second half. In the first half, when Yuri Collins was off the floor in foul trouble, they were just about as bad as you can get. Those last 8 minutes were what almost killed them. And I don't have the plus minus in front of me. I wish I did. It feels like they were like plus 20 when Collins was on the court.
Yeah, well, as we know, he is going to continue to be important for St. Louis. But any other final thoughts on this weekend? It was another pretty good one in the A-10, but anything else to touch on before we revisit some of our hot takes? Because we thought this might be a fun little segment. See how things have changed now that we're about halfway through the conference season.
I mean, we covered the midweek games on our last episode with where we also talked to GW coach Chris Caputo. So be sure to go back and listen to that if you haven't already. And other than that, Dayton looked great again. UMass, a big win that we already talked about. I guess the only other thing to put in is that Fordham just moved into a double bye spot. They have been incredible since their lineup change, putting Will Richardson and Rostik Nowitzki in the starting lineup.
Yeah, this has to be the highest in the standings Fordham has been this late in the season since like 2005, 2006. They had a couple of years where they were decent, but this is really impressive, and they're 17-4 right now. All right, so to end tonight's episode, we recorded a pre-conference season hot takes, the Power 11 hot takes, since unfortunately the A-10's dropped off a little bit and it's not the Power 8 anymore. But we wanted to go back and revisit some of these opinions, see how we did with any of our predictions. And so we'll just go rapid fire here, one at a time. Shout out again to Stu Ledecky and Chris Pyle for joining us. This was a really fun episode. I had a good time going back and listening to see what we came up with. But we'll just go down the list. Tyler, you can give your opinions on each of these. Stu said that no team would be better than 13-5 in conference.
It's going to be close, but it's not going to happen. Like, St. Louis is already 7-1. Even if they go 6-4 here, that would be because they get smacked around by Dayton or VCU. So I was optimistic at the time Dayton could get to 16. Obviously, they'd have to wait. They have three already. Yeah, they can't get there at all. I think maybe someone gets to 15. You're definitely going to have to get to 14 to win the title.
I think so, too. That's just kind of been the historical trend, and especially with St. Louis getting that tough win against Davidson. That's going to make it tough for anyone to get less than 14. But
only thing to note before you go on, St. Louis has not played VCU or Dayton at all yet. So they have four of those games, and then Dayton and VCU still have to play each other again. So they're going to start knocking each other out.
Ken Pom has them at 13-5, tied with VCU for the top projection. So it's possible. But so Chris had kind of the opposite take. He said Dayton or St. Louis would win with either a 15-3 or 16-2 record. And like you said, we know Dayton's not going 16-2. Does St. Louis have any hope of that?
No, because I still hate the Dayton matchup for them. Like, as much as Dayton struggled, I still just massively prefer the Flyers in that head-to-head. And so that's a 1-1 at best for the Billikens, I think.
Yeah, I just feel like for St. Louis, like the four games against VCU and Dayton, I mean, I'd say the most likely is they go 2-2 in those, but then they'd still have to win the rest of their games to get the 15-3, and that's tough. So, possible. Your first take of that episode was that Dayton would win the conference by multiple games, and this looked really good when the Flyers started out hot the first couple games. Really, it looked great until the second half against VCU.
I think I still pick them, but it's by a game or by tiebreaker.
I think it would almost have to be by a tiebreaker.
First of all, they have to go 3-0 in those St. Louis VCU games.
Yeah.
But then to do so, they still need each of them to lose at least one really stupid game.
I mean, Dayton is still, they're favored in all of their games except for at VCU and at St. Louis. So, like, if they can split those and win the rest, they can get the 14-4, but that wouldn't be a multiple game title. Definitely.
They probably have to win out at this point.
All right, here's another questionable Dayton take. This is something that Chris and I agreed on, that Tumani Kamara was Dayton's best player and not Daron Holmes. I feel like right after we said that, Daron Holmes went on the best six-game stretch that we've seen in 5 years. Like, even more dominant than what Obi Toppin did, or Bones.
Yeah, and in the VCU game, you guys were right. But let's be honest, they're both incredible defensively.
Mm-hmm.
To the point that despite Dayton's struggles, I think they're still basically competing with each other for Defensive Player of the Year. I'd give Kamara a slight edge right now. But it's pretty clear that Holmes is just the better offensive player.
Yeah, we did both say that we liked Kamara for Defensive Player of the Year, and I don't know. I'd have to think about that some more, but I think he's still in the running. All right.
I still think he's the overwhelming favorite, but
here was the UMass take that we mentioned at the beginning of the podcast from Stu, and he said that UMass was not only a double bye team, but a definite double bye team. And my favorite part about this take, he mentioned the Minutemen's really easy schedule. And he said that they played GW, St. Joe's, Fordham, and Rhodey twice. Those are four teams that have suddenly been playing pretty well the last 2 weeks. And all of a sudden, they still have a favorable schedule, but that's not as easy as we thought it was going to be.
Yeah, and by the way, they're 1-2 in the, against those teams so far.
And their other home and home is LaSalle, who they lost to. So 1-3 in their home and home.
Oh, sorry. Yeah, right 1-3. I missed the GW loss in there when I was looking at the schedule real quick.
Yeah, and haven't played for them yet. All right.
Well, by the way, I do want to say that's not a completely dead take.
It's well, not.
Last week, it seems like it easily was.
Well, I think that they're not a definite double bye team. I mean, if they get in, it's going to be on some tiebreakers, yeah, probably. But that could happen. All right, you had a Duquesne take here that Trey Clark would be all conference. And this is my favorite. You had them in fourth place and that he would lead the Dukes to a tiebreaker over VCU. Well, that was right on the money.
Yeah, that was his completely
VCU
right.
Game, that was incredible, but how do you think he's looking for all conference right now?
He has not shot the ball well at all since that game. The Dukes as a team shot well the next two games, and then they've kind of cratered as well. It's still in play. I haven't gone through and sketched out like an actual like player ranking so far. I would say right now he's probably on the outside looking in, but because of the steals numbers that he generates and the fact that he's right in the all defensive team discussion, plus the fact that he's still the Duke's second most important player, if he can find his shot again here in early February, he's very much in that. I'd say it's about 50-50 at this point.
Yeah, I think if it kind of just depends on Duquesne's team success, like if they're going to end up being good enough to get two guys on the all-conference team, but if they were to get a second, I think it's him. Now, this might be my favorite take. I think I hit a home run. I said that Ace Baldwin's assist rate, which at the time was fourth in the nation, was the most impressive stat in the A-10. And I said if he could maintain that VCU's offense would improve and it would be enough for the Rams to win the conference. Well, right now he's 13th in the country, so dropped off a little bit. But VCU is the fourth best offense in conference play right now, per KenPom, and doesn't look quite as great after they lost to St. Bonaventure, but I feel like you gotta have Ace in consideration for player of the year if VCU wins the conference. His stats might not be quite that of Yuri Collins or Daron Holmes, but nobody is as important to their team as he is, or at least no one's more important.
Well, I actually don't think he's gonna win player of the year unless VCU finds a way to win the conference by multiple games, because the counting stats still just don't look like that of a player of the year. And I got a scorching hot take right now. I think it's possible that VCU wins the conference and Ace doesn't even make first team, which might blow up A10 Twitter.
That would be awful. It's going to be like a Jordair Jett situation where he only averaged like 12 points, but St. Louis was so good that year. Like whoever wins the conference, they're getting a first team guy.
Well, when you look at this, like he's not going to have as good a stats on paper as Holmes, Collins, Burton, Oduro, Bishop. That's five right there. And yeah, so then like, is there a universe where maybe he falls behind Tamani Kamara, even if VCU finishes ahead of Dayton? I think that's in play. Now, if they win the conference, Ace's absolutely should be first team because he's so ridiculously critically important to that team. But I'm just going to say that it is very well in play and Twitter might explode if that happens.
I don't think it will. I think part of it between Tyler Burton and Josh Oduro, I just think one of their teams will go like 7-11 and kick them out. There's going to be a spot for Ace. I'm confident in that. But the next take from Chris, that there would only be two coaching changes. And looking back, I kind of feel like there's not going to be any right now, but I'm curious how you feel. St. Joe's is all of a sudden.
If St. Joe's didn't fire Billy Lang last year with the recruits they have coming in next year, if that team goes like 8-10, I would be downright stunned if he got fired.
I still, it's what I said before. If Fran Dunphy retires, which could happen, I don't really think any A10 coach has earned a better job with what they've done this year. So I don't see anyone moving up.
The only other wild card, and we've talked about it, is with St. Louis playing really well right now, it would take an unbelievable collapse for Ford to get canned. But if they are shaky down the stretch, all of a sudden they finish in third and get bounced in the quarters of the semis, maybe he does leave for a job that's a half a step down for the stability of that move.
The only other wild card I would say, which not to speculate anything, but I do think Keith Dambrot is the last person in the world that would want a farewell tour. Like, he wouldn't say anything ahead of time if he was going to retire, but I feel like he's got a few more years at least.
He is not. There's no chance that guy's retiring.
He seems like because the type of guy that could do this 10 more years if he
wants. I don't know what he would do with himself if he did. The energy is still at the same exact level. He is still going completely insane on players.
I would think. Like, I guess if he was going to retire, he probably would have done it after last year.
Yeah, he's made it clear he doesn't really want another job. That team is way too good by Duquesne standards for him to be even close to the hot seat. And I don't think he's ever going to want to walk away from coaching. If he continues to be a quality coach at Duquesne, I think he's there at least another decade.
In the last take here before we move on, Anthony Grant's not going anywhere. So knock it off, everyone. It's not a conversation right now. Like, not worth talking about.
If they lose every game the rest of the season, he might get fired.
He'd get
if they finish top four, his seat is a nice, cool 32 degrees.
Yeah, whether you like it or not, I mean,
no chance Anthony Grant is getting canned.
By the way, appreciated that he wore the suit against Richmond on Saturday. I wish he'd keep that up because Dayton, I have to add this up, but if you go back to the 19-20 season, I'm pretty sure Dayton is on like a 28-game winning streak when he wears a suit. You'll have to let me know, did he wear a suit against Colorado in the neutral site Chicago game? Because that's...
God, I've chosen to pretend that night didn't happen.
I have too, I don't remember. But I feel like coaches... See, now no one wears a suit except for Dunphy, but I feel like coaches used to not wear suits in those games.
Chris Mooney still wears a suit.
Yeah, he's like the only one. And Matt McKillop,
all the time.
Too.
Since we're talking about the suits, I do want to mention real quick, if anyone saw Duquesne Loyola, like the actual game and not the prank, Drew Valentine's shoes were Loyola gold. They were brighter than the fake DoorDash guy's jacket. They were awesome to see up close from the court level. And he paired it with this just putrid burgundy suit. And I get that it was Loyola colors, but oh my God, it was awful. And it's one of those things that might have actually worked if he had gone like black shoes, black tie, like something toned down. But with the bright shoes and that being the color that was supposed to kind of bring the stuff down, if anyone saw it, oh my God, it was bad.
Yeah, I appreciate the effort, but we're not going to have another Kyle Neptune in this conference with his style. You're just not going to match that.
I do want to see Valentine break out the gold shoes, gold tie again, though, with a different suit color, because those were sweet.
Yeah. All right, we have two more takes. Chris said that six teams would end up going 9-9. And right now we have 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7. We have 7 teams within a game of that. So 6 teams are 4-5 at the moment. St. Bonaventure improved to 5-4. That one's very live. It could happen.
Right now, 3 losses gets you in third place. 5 losses for half of those teams put you in the pillow fight.
Yeah, I don't even want to think about the tiebreakers right
no
now.
No one's actually better than anyone else.
No. All right, the last take, this was yours, that a pillow fighter would win multiple games and that someone outside the top four makes the semis. Well,
I'm significantly more confident in that now.
The first part's almost a guarantee because we're going to get like a UMass or a Mason or a Richmond or St. Joe's. Like, there's going to be an okay team that plays on Tuesday. I mean, really, I kind of think the only really bad teams right now are LaSalle and Loyola. Maybe Rhode Island, but they've just won two in a row and they're looking better. So
I think Rhode Island is bad in general, but also incredibly dangerous on a night-to-night basis.
Yeah, they could get hot in Brooklyn. And then for somebody outside the top four making the semis, I mean, this is already something that happened last year. So I do think this one's a little bit tougher, actually, just because I still think St. Louis, VCU, and Dayton are a clear top three. And by the way, that's the order I put them in before the conference season, and looking a little bit better right now than you might have thought. It's going to be tough, though. I mean, it could happen. It's not uncommon in the A-10, but I don't think that one's as likely.
So, because you just hit on what I want to end this episode on, but I guess it wasn't a hot take. I guess I just said it, but I thought Fordham will go 9-9 was one of mine. They're 5-3 right now, so I'm getting a little bit nervous, but you know what? Actually, no, I don't feel great about that anymore because they're just better with Will Richardson on the court. And the team that I thought was going to go 9-9 is just, it's not that team. It's not their team anymore. So
yeah,
God, I'm almost ready to lock them in as a top half team. Richardson is amazing.
That reminds me, I missed the hot take. I said, and now you reminded me because it doesn't look as certain. I said that Maximus Edwards would run away with Rookie of the Year.
He was until RJ Lewis did what he did this week.
Yeah, Lewis, but then Richardson too, all of a sudden playing really well for Fordham.
Yeah, we'll see. He's got a lot of ground to make up to the point that I'm not even sure he would be all rookie team at the moment.
Well,
he's going to get pace. He's going to get there, but
yeah.
So you mentioned Dayton, St. Louis, VCU are head and shoulders above everybody else. And that's absolutely right. And I'm starting to look ahead to the A-10 tournament. And I'll give this with the caveat. I have enough enjoyment out of this conference that I rarely bet on it. I basically only do if I look at something and I feel like there's just an unbelievable value. And that basically equates to like 2 to 3 games a season. I didn't bet on anything in the last two conference tournaments. I'm already looking forward to the betting opportunities we're going to get going into this A-10 tournament. Because if you can grab any of these three at 3-1 or higher, I think everyone should just take it because we're at the point that I'm pretty sure they're about even with each other. And someone's going to get hot at the end. They're going to come in at wonky odds compared to the other two. And I would just want to get the value and get the long odds on any of them.
I agree. And there's been points throughout this whole season, like I think St. Louis for a while looked like the best team after they beat Providence, and then Dayton after, you know, going on a 6 or 7 game winning streak in the first 2 weeks of conference play, they looked like the clear favorites. And then as soon as VCU went and won at UD Arena, they were the favorites. And now all of a sudden it seems like it's shifted back to the Billikens. Yeah. The conference favorite title has changed hands 4 or 5 times, but the common denominator is that it's always between this group. And I think it's going to be really important whoever gets that one seed, because if you assume that this ends up being your top three, you avoid, I mean, it's still going to be a challenging semifinal game, but not at the same level as if you're playing the 2 or 3 seed.
Well, and I'm going to go to the other end of this. I think everyone should pick who they like the best of everyone else going into this tournament. And if they end up 4, 5, 8, 9, and you can get them at like 25, 30-1, you throw a little half unit flyer on that too, because this has the potential for the ultimate chaos tournament. And the 6 and 7 seeds honestly are going to be kind of screwed unless they get some real great luck there. Because none of these middle teams are anywhere near the top-end talent of last year's Richmond team. One of the things I don't think we ever gave them proper credit for is last year it was really clear that VCU, Dayton, and Davidson were a notch above everyone else by the time the season ended. Richmond beat those three in 3 days in succession. No one is doing that this year. But I liken this, and by this point in the pod, and the amount of people who have the proper tennis A10 men's basketball crossover knowledge. There might literally be like two people left who understand what I'm about to say here. And I really hope that they appreciate this analogy. This tournament is going to be the US Open from a men's tennis perspective, where that's the one major every year where all the top guys, none of them have a systemic advantage on that court style. And so you go into it, there's three to four heavy favorites who are all pretty even with each other. And then you just have like seven other guys that could all swing a huge upset on any given day. And it feels like any of them could be one or two lucky breaks away from really having a chance to win it. And let's look at a hypothetical with the standings right now. So let's say GW, who's the five seed, they win their 5-12 game, they beat Fordham. Now they get a day off to rest up from those two games. Well, maybe St. Louis loses to George Mason. Those two keep playing great one possession games every time they face off. Well, maybe this time Oduro gets the last laugh. And now you're GW, you get to play George Mason in the semis. You're what, probably a 1-2 point favorite in that game? You pull that out. One of the two between Dayton and VCU knocks each other out. And now you blink and you're in the finals. And you haven't had to play any of the top three till that moment. And now all you got to do is have Bishop or Adams get hot on that Sunday and you're going to the NCAA tournament. And like all these teams from like 4 to 11, there's not that much of a difference between them. So if you get the right matchups, you're going to have to beat one of the three. But if things go your way, you might only have to beat one.
It could. And I think part of the fun thing about all these middle of the road teams too being equal, like if you're the one seed, your first game of the tournament could be against a James Bishop or a Josh Oduro or a Tyler Burton. Like a lot of these teams, or Foster Lawyer, whoever, like a lot of these teams have someone that could just light you up at any point. And I do think even though we like this top little group of three, there's so many teams that could swing a big upset like you're talking about.
I look, once we get part of the way this is all lined up, with the top being weaker and the middle being stronger, if you make it to the quarterfinals, you're going to be capable of beating anybody. Even if it's a pillow fight team getting there, like I predicted, like that could be St. Joe's on a hot streak. That could be like any number of the teams out of Duquesne, Richmond, George Mason, UMass, St. Bonaventure, Fordham, GW. Like at least one of those teams mathematically has to be in the pillow fight.
Yeah. And
by the way, this is all going to lead to the best, most entertaining second round we have ever had. Wednesday is just going to be fantastic.
It is. No, I can't wait. I think this, especially since it is truly turning into a one bid scenario with VCU going down this week. You know, it's actually funny too, because Friday night during the St. Louis Davidson game, you had Joe Bernardi called in to the broadcast with terrible reception from the bunker, like way worse than the quality that we're giving you right now. And he was confident the A-10 would be getting two bids. Now that was before St. Bonaventure pulled the upset of the season so far. But unless if St. Louis like just about runs the table, we're pretty much looking at an all or nothing situation in Brooklyn.
We are one shaky St. Louis loss away from never having to say at large the rest of the season.
Yeah. Just embrace it at this point.
Because by the way, like they did beat Providence and Memphis. If they go like 16-2, they actually probably will make it. But
yeah, I mean, they only won
16-2 of the season of chaos.
No one is. No way. Not St. Louis.
It's the Conference of Chaos. I can't believe the Sickos committee has yet to award the A-10 with some sort of special title this year. Because if anyone's a college basketball junkie who knows this, please tell us if there's been a conference more utterly insane than this one this year. Because I don't understand how that would be possible.
I mean, you're one of the biggest Sickos in college basketball if you're listening over an hour into an A-10 podcast, and if you've been watching these games every week, but it's fun. And even though the conference hasn't been as great this year, I don't know about you, it hasn't reduce my enjoyment of the games. There's still so many stories to follow. The games are close. It's just entertainment.
I'm having more fun because I actually want to watch everyone this year.
Yeah, I mean, there's
like,
not
by
really
by this point, almost every year, I'm completely out on like two teams unless they're playing each other.
Yeah, like there's not as many teams this year where I just have no interest in seeing what happens to them or watching any of their games, which is a good thing. Like even the bad teams are, there are some redeeming qualities, I feel like.
Yeah, Loyola is getting close, but they're not there yet. So,
yeah, they still like sometimes don't even feel like an A-10 team to me though. They need to win. At least they're in the win column. I guess they somehow beat St. Bonaventure. Good for them.
Yep. Well, nothing that happens to St. Bonaventure makes any sense. And I want that to be the parting thought of this episode. That St. Bonaventure is complete chaos. And here's my gambling advice of the episode. Just don't bet on games that involve St. Bonaventure. Just don't do it.
I've been betting them at home, and then I got burned against Fordham.
Don't bet on them. Don't bet against them. They're stay away.
Yeah.
But that does it for this episode. As we mentioned last week, we're heading out to D.C. and then down to Richmond this weekend for Duquesne at GW and Fordham at Richmond. We've already gotten some good recommendations, but if anyone's got some good tips for a good place to grab a drink, to grab a meal, or anything that we should make sure we go see on the respective GW or Richmond campuses while we're there, please just reach out to us on Twitter, slide into our DMs, reply to us at whatever way works. If you've enjoyed the show, please give us 5 stars on iTunes. Please leave a comment on there. We really appreciate those. Reviews looking very nice, so thank you guys for that. And yeah, chaos, 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 chaos. Let that word linger around in your brain.